it's looking really like the poor cousin. It's so embarrassing. I don't want to put people in it because it's so...
You're listening to the Luxury Mind podcast with Paul Russell and Helen Villers, exploring human behaviour, psychology and luxury.
Welcome back to the Luxury Mind. I am Helen Villers and I am joined by my co-host Paul Russell. What are we talking about today, Paul?
We are talking about something really interesting called the Diderot effect. Now, you said something really interesting last week, or the week before, whenever it was. You said that you were talking to people and they said, I'm not influenced by anything.
Yes.
Influence doesn't work on me, or my husband is too savvy. I can't remember the conversation. And I thought to myself, I'm going to prove you wrong, because of course my ego got in the way. And that's where we're going to talk about the Diderot effect.
Okay. Tell me all about the Diderot effect.
Well,
because
it's
I've read a little bit.
Do you know what it is? So basically,
well, I've a tiny bit, but you describe it because you'll know better.
So in the 1700s, there was a philosopher called Denis Diderot, right? Now, he didn't have a lot of money. He was quite broke, as philosophers tend to be. And, well, it's not exactly a high-paying job, is it?
No.
So he was gifted a robe, you know, like a bathrobe or a smoking jacket or something like this, a dressing gown. And it was really expensive and really beautiful. And, of course, he fell in love with it. But what happened was, because he had this spectacularly fabulous new dressing gown that he was rocking around in, being fabulous, everything else in his house and all of his clothes looked crap in comparison. So he thought to himself, well, you know, I've got this fabulous new dressing gown, so of course I need new slippers. And I need new expensive slippers. And of course, because I need new expensive slippers, I need new expensive pajamas, because my old pajamas won't go well with my new dressing gown or my new slippers. And that's essentially what the Diderot effect is. The Diderot effect is when you buy something and then you start comparing that something that you buy against everything else around you. And it causes this cascade effect where you just keep shopping. So you will have heard the phrase, you know, Pringles is a prime example. Once you pop, you can't stop.
Yes, so that's very true.
That's the Diderot effect. And the Diderot effect is once you shop, you can't stop. So, and everybody falls into it.
So this is a little bit like if I clean one area of my kitchen, it makes the rest of the kitchen look terrible because there's this one section that's gorgeous and then. So it's the same thing, right?
It's the same thing. But,
okay. So if I'm walking around in, I don't know, a Burberry Mac, but I'm pairing it with shoes from Tesco's, no judgment, but if I was doing that, the shoes from Tesco's would feel very out of place, would they not?
They would feel out of place, but you would feel that the shoes from Tesco are not keeping up with the Joneses of the Burberry Mac. So you'd have to buy new shoes and you would justify it to yourself by buying new Prada shoes or Gucci shoes or YSL shoes, that you can only buy these shoes because they go with the Burberry Mac.
There's part of me that really loves, though, when I'm walking around in leggings and a hoodie with my Mulberry handbag. Like, what's that about? The look of disdain on your face. What's going on there? I'm scared.
Okay. Basically saying to yourself, justifying to yourself, why you're carrying a hideously expensive handbag and walking around in leggings, because you're going, yes, well, you know, I've got this handbag and I'm fabulous with the handbag. However, if somebody came up to you and went, I love your handbag, and then glanced at your leggings, you would now suddenly feel that those leggings were incredibly out of place. And you would think, oh, crap, I probably should have worn something different. to go with my bag?
I don't know. I think I'd find it quite funny. You don't believe me at all, do you?
I don't believe you, because everybody thinks that they're immune to this sort of stuff. You know, yes. So here's the thing. You buy a new phone, right?
Right.
Now what do you need to buy? A new
Headphones. Oh, and a case, yeah.
Something else that goes...
A screen protector.
Yeah, everything else. What's wrong with the one you already have? If it fits the new phone...
Mm-hmm.
You'd still buy new ones. So you buy a new car, for example, and mm-hmm. it's all lovely and it's wonderful. Now you're thinking of things that you need to buy for the car because what you have just isn't good enough. So you might need a new keyring, or you might need a new steering wheel cover, or you might need a new bobble for the windscreen, or whatever the case may be.
I'm going to confess something because...
Tell me everything.
I do anyway. But so in my living room, I redecorated my living room last year, and it was obviously kitted out and it was all beautiful and lovely. And I bought a new sofa to go in the living room.
Fabulous.
But the original living room sofas were perfectly fine. They're only a couple of years old. They're lovely. They're fine. But every time I go in there now, I look at them with a bit of disdain, like... You're not really keeping up the vibe here. Like, this is meant to be opulence, and they are lovely. Don't get me wrong, but I do think maybe I should have gone.
So the Diderot effect sofas. Would be you walking in, going, "Oh, my lovely new sofa needs a new carpet. Oh, my lovely new sofa needs better ornaments." You know, or when you paint a room, suddenly that room is lovely and very nice, and now the rest of the house. Looks shabby compared to that.
That is that's something I very much relate to at the moment because I've been doing a lot of redecorating in my house. And so every time, like, say, we did this room to start with, then we've done the living room, my daughter's bedroom. We didn't redecorate it, but we refurnished it. You know, we did it all, and then we're just at this very moment redecorating my hall and landing. Quite a big space in my house. And I'm just sort of, there's one bedroom that hasn't been redecorated and it's looking really like the poor cousin. It's so embarrassing. I don't want to put people in it because it's so desperately in need of it. And yeah, it's fascinating what it's kind of does psychologically that suddenly something that was absolutely fine, that had no problem at all, now is looking really shabby. And like, I really need to redo that as well.
But it's only shabby dreadful, in comparison really. To the other things, to the shiny new things. So this is especially prevalent at the luxury end of the market. You know, when you buy your first luxury item. So, for example, and I'm going to shame you.
Because, oh God, here we go.
As you said before we went on air, that you have all of the lovely handbags and the expensive handbags. And if somebody bought you a River Island handbag, you would scrunch up your nose. You'd be very grateful and say, thank you very much. That's going to be absolutely beautiful at the back of my wardrobe.
But that's your words and not mine, but yes, I did agree with them.
But it's never going to see the light of day because in comparison to my other handbags, it's the poor cousin. This is the thing about luxury. You know, a lot of it is hedonic adaptation. And hedonic adaptation is when you get used to something, it ceases to be luxury. We've talked about this before.
Mm-hmm.
Luxury is subjective. Once you acquire something, you always want something better. Once you go from economy to premium economy in an airplane, you never want to go back to premium economy. You want to go to business class.
Yeah. Yes, I can see that as well, because we last time we did long haul, it was in premium economy. And the idea of having to go back and do a 10-hour flight in economy with two children.
Your knees behind your ears.
Oh, just no, thank you. No, don't know, thanks.
Exactly. And we do this all the time with everything. So if you have, let's say, for example, you say, oh, well, you know, I need a new suit. or I need a new dress. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah.
Women especially, not being sexist, but it's just a fact that if you go, oh, I've got a wedding coming up, I've got an event coming up, and I see this with my business partner all the time, and yes, it may be anecdotal, but I also see it with my sister and my mother and other friends. They would go, oh, well, I have an event coming up, so I need to buy a new outfit. I need to buy a new dress. And mm-hmm. that dress will become shoes and a dress.
Yes.
And a blouse and a handbag and jewelry and everything else that goes with
and
it.
Hair and hair.
And yeah. everything, because what they already have in their wardrobe, which is bursting to capacity, just isn't good enough.
Do you know, I read an article once that said that on average, to attend a wedding, so as a guest, not as a bridesmaid or a member of the wedding party, costs a woman around £400 just in her outfit, not to include the accommodation or anything else. It's just on their outfits around £400.
Yes, but why?
Because we all want to look the best.
So Shanine has a party coming up, which is my business partner, in, I don't know, 3 or 4 days? This weekend, whenever it is. And last night on the phone, she said, I've got nothing to wear.
She doesn't, though. I believe her. She doesn't.
This is
because they've seen it.
With wardrobes of clothes in 3 different houses.
She does not have anything to wear. I believe her. I'm backing her all the way. All the way. Because you can't go to these things in something that you've worn before that they have seen. That you can't... There's such a social hierarchy or narcissism even around this that we have to be show-stopping when we walk into these events. And you can't wear the dress you wore to the last party. I've got a favourite dress that I wear to events. And it's got to the point now I can't wear it anymore because even though I love it, I feel comfortable in it. It looks nice. I've worn it that many times that it's too familiar to people. And
but is yeah. it? I mean, people don't yeah. notice as much as you believe they do.
I agree with that. That's something I tell my clients all the time is that whilst you're sitting there worrying about everyone staring at you, they're doing exactly the same thing and completely self-centered thinking. So that is absolutely true. But it is about my self-worth. I think it's more about me feeling good about myself, that I'm wearing something new that I know looks good, that is something. I went to one wedding. This is one of my very best friends. It was awful. And to this day, I still question this person. The wedding was wonderful.
Okay.
The wedding with your face. I was like, no. The wedding was brilliant. But no, I turned up at this wedding. So I had been at her house prior to us all leaving to go to the chapel. And I turned up and I was wearing this gorgeous dress from Hobbs. And it was beautiful, really, really sweet, really pretty. I had a nice little white jacket, bolero jacket. It was a lot thinner in those days.
Yeah.
And you know, so I look good. And turn up at this wedding and there's a woman in the same dress as me, exactly the same dress. And she came roaring up to me going, oh, isn't it funny? And I'm thinking, no, it fucking isn't funny, but okay. Because we have to play the social game. What made it worse was she only lived a few doors up from my friend, had seen me leaving the house in the same dress to get into the car to go to the church and still turned up in the same dress. She didn't think I should change because outrageous.
Absolutely outrageous. I mean, outrageous. Terrible. You wouldn't believe how many times as a man with a navy blue suit, I see other men with navy blue suits. You know, I just
right, but this is the disparity. This is the disparity between men and women, is that women have to, there is a pressure to always look unique. Men are meant to be sort of standard and staid and
uniform
so that the women can stand out as peacocks, can't we? You know, it's the... Even though peacocks are actually male, but yeah, exactly.
In the animal world, the male is the one doing
typically,
peacocking.
Yeah. But in human being world, because we are still animals, but in human being world, the women are expected to be, well, look at the makeup and hair. The degrees that, look how much makeup I'm wearing versus what you're wearing, right? Like,
I mean, Mine is quite thick, troweled on, so I'm probably wearing more than you are. But yes, I get
it. I don't think so. But, you know, like, how long did you spend doing your hair today?
3 minutes.
Right. And how often do you have to go and get your hair done, and how much does it cost?
I guess it cuts about once a month, and I think it's £25.
Mine is £137, and I should probably be going every couple of months, but I don't because I haven't got time. But £137 on my hair, then to get my hair ready, because it's expected, because it's the Diderot effect, isn't it?
Well, no, that's social comparison and escalation commitment.
Okay, but isn't it?
So escalation commitment is, well, you know, I spend this much on my hair, so I might as well continue spending this much on my hair because it becomes a norm. So suddenly, to me, if you said to me, okay, Paul, to get your hair cut is going to be £50, I would say, no, I'm going to find somebody else because that's not my norm. Now, having said that, because you live basically in the middle of nowhere, I know that...
I just don't live in London. That's all it is, isn't it? Yes.
Right, that's my point. You need a passport to get to where Helen lives. So anyway, if you said to my business partner or my sister, I spend £137 on my hair every couple of months, they would go, oh my God, what a bargain. Where do you get somebody who'll do
so
cut,
cheap,
colouring, blah, blah, for such a little amount of money? Mm-hmm. Because their escalation commitment is maybe 200 or 300 mm-hmm. or however much you lot stupidly play on something that you could do yourself from a box from Tesco.
Absolutely cannot do it ourselves from a box.
I've seen these boxes and these ads.
They're all lies, Paul.
They all look the same.
They're all lies. Let me tell you about the time that I did a box dye. This was before I had enough money to spend £137 on my hair. And I thought I had done a wonderful job, because how hard can it be just to paint your hair?
Exactly, it's not rocket
cream.
Science.
It's not, no. And then I toddled off to my cupcake market, and one of the men went, oh, I like the tiger stripes. And I had missed massive chunks of it. I'd missed huge chunks of my hair. So I had this red and brown contrasting hair. And
so you were
ridiculous.
Rocking a statement. You weren't actually it,
no intention
to rock.
Of doing it at all. No.
Okay. And then what did you do?
Wore my hair up for months. I think I got a friend over, actually, and we redid it. But it was just, I mean, yes, you can't just do it out of a box. But I wonder also if this is Diderot then, because, so if I've had my hair done, then I feel like I have to do my face as well. Because 100%. I can't, right. And then I have to look nice in what I'm wearing, like my clothes, because my hair looks nice and it's such a contrast. Last night I was wearing a sweatshirt and, you know, just a casual thing. I recorded a video and I was like, gosh, it looks dreadful because my hair is all beautiful.
Your hair has all been done and you spent so much money on it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that would be an element of the Diderot effect for sure, but there would be other elements involved in that. You know, there would be the social comparison. There would be the idea that what your hair now no longer matches what you're wearing. So you should up your game. But it's like makeup, isn't it? I see this with friends and with my sister and all the rest of it. They will spend terrific amounts of money on a lipstick or on a foundation. And then these are people with enough makeup and enough products that when you walk into their dressing rooms, they could actually open their own concession.
Are
you one of those people?
So makeup is a hyper focus for me. So it's a special interest. So I've been collecting makeup since I was 8. And it's, I mean, not everything in my makeup collection, nothing is still existing from when I was 8. I have to just point out. But no, don't worry, we're not 37 years of old makeup. But no, I've got drawers and drawers and drawers, and it's all organised, and it's all, I mean.
Right, so you could open your own makeup concession.
Without even,
however,
you could walk in now.
When you get this fabulously expensive lipstick or this ridiculously expensive mascara, suddenly you now have the makeup that you have doesn't go with it. So now I need to buy even more expensive foundation, and more expensive blush, and more expensive eyeshadow. Let me ask you this. How many bloody eyeshadow palettes does one woman need?
Well, need, first of all, you have to define how many colours are in the palette, because there are lots of different types of palettes.
This is where the cognitive dissonance kicks in. Carry on.
Okay. So, in terms of palettes, I think I have got, and I'm just going to have to add this up really quickly, but I've definitely got I think I've got about 20. His face.
And how?
And that's full size. That's like when there's like 8 to 12 or more colours. Then I've got lots of little 4 palettes, you know.
Absolutely.
Don't know how many of those. But I'm obsessed. I am genuinely obsessed. If I have spare money, it's immediately going on makeup. I'm literally obsessed.
I mean, it's an Oscar Wilde moment, isn't it?
Oscar
Wilde said, "I'm incredibly easily pleased. I'm always satisfied with the best."
It's true. Yeah. Absolutely. I can resist everything but temptation.
I can resist everything but temptation. Exactly.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's this idea that, but then of course, you know, you also have to take into consideration the consumer culture that we live in. You know, there is this idea that, you know, retail therapy has become a pastime. And this, once you start to see buying stuff as a hobby or a stress reliever or something that is leisure focused rather than something that is needed, then all sorts of stuff starts to kick in, because you see the endowment effect kicking in, which is when I own something, it's much more important and much better than when somebody else owns it. So because I have bought this particular makeup or this particular skincare, then it's much better than everybody else's. And of course, then I have to match this skincare right across the board. You know, I can't possibly use La Prairie moisturizer and Nivea nighttime cream. That would just be, you know, I would die in my sleep probably from a skin reaction if I did that. You know, so you've got
La Prairie would know, they'd hunt me down.
Exactly. You'd get a knock on the door in the middle of the night going, "Excuse me, you have mixed our product with something." And then you've got this whole idea of, you know, the I've spent this much money, I might as well just keep continuing to spend this much money. And this retail therapy then turns into something where it becomes an addiction and you need it. So you now associate buying one item with building something else around that item.
Right.
And that can be very dangerous. The Diderot effect itself can be quite dangerous, because it can lead to maladaptive shopping, maladaptive behavior, and addictive practices. So, you know, when you say,
I can see that.
Because people will say, I've watched people sit on their phone bored buying stuff on eBay simply because this rush of dopamine that they get when the packages arrive.
Yeah.
But then these packages stay completely unopened in a corner.
Yeah. That's something I see quite a lot of as well. There's this need to shop. But eBay being particular about the anticipation build up, especially if you're bidding on something, there's just this huge hormonal response to it anyway, but all the addictive kind of what we see in addiction, certainly in my world, is this, that a lot of it's about the anticipation rather than the actual taking or the impact or the effect of the drug. A lot of it's about the ritual in building up to it, the anticipation, the getting, the scoring it kind of thing. But then, and then you take it and it's almost not what you need it to be. It's disappointing. It's a bit like when you have a gin and tonic and you think, oh, it's going to be amazing. And you get your tonic and you get your gin and maybe you've gone for something slightly posher and then you get your ice and you slice your lemon and then you pop it in and you da-da-da-da-da. And then you have the first sip and, oh, it's not as good as I thought it was going to be. There's something disappointing about it. And so eBay is particularly tricky for this kind of dopamine addiction type behavior. But I see this with shopping all the time. I do actually a thing with a friend of mine when we're feeling a bit down in the dumps or overwhelmed or whatever, the fantasy shopping, where we talk about all the things that if we had all the money in the world, we would buy. And it seems to really relieve and alleviate that kind of need to shop, but also then creates an urge to want to do more to be able to kind of get those things a little bit. But yeah, it's a...
I can see that.
Yeah.
But it's particularly prevalent amongst luxury consumers. Now, And I'm not talking about high net worth luxury consumers. I'm talking about consumers who buy luxury. Because a lot of the times, consumers who buy luxury are not actually high net worth individuals.
Yeah.
They're people who maybe have a decent salary or have a high limit on their credit card or whatever the case may be. And then this buying of luxury becomes a drug. It becomes an addiction. So they will go in and they will buy a pair of Louboutin shoes. And then the Diderot effect kicks in, which is, well, I've got these shoes, so now let me go over to Chanel and buy a dress, or let me go to Dior and buy something that goes with this. And then the escalation kicks in, the commitment escalation kicks in, where it's, well, you know what, I've spent £5,000, I might as well just keep going. And then, of course, there's the FOMO effect, the fear of missing out, where people go, well, if I don't get this now, they say it's limited edition, and I need to buy it. And yes, I know that there are bailiffs banging on the door demanding that I pay my credit card bills. But you know what? Another £500 is not going to make any difference. They're still going to be banging on the door. And all of these chemical releases and all of these behavioral patterns that you see get worse and worse and worse and worse until eventually you have essentially destroyed your life. That got dark very quick, didn't it?
That did get dark really quickly. But that is what we're talking about. It's a trap, isn't it? There's such a spiral, such a wormhole that we could get caught in this kind of effect, this behavior of I need this thing to match this thing to match this thing to match this thing. If I go on a holiday, I can't possibly go on a 3-star. I must go on a 5-star. And then if I'm going 5-star, well, I might as well fly first class because what's the point? Otherwise, I'm just ruining the effect, right? It's such a... Go on, what are you chuckling?
This is 100% it. What you have just described is the Diderot effect with the escalation commitment effect.
Right.
Side by side, in a nutshell. And
it's like I could be a consumer behaviorist, couldn't I, Paul?
Yes, I know that. Now, I will say, consumer behavior psychologists do not activate the Diderot effect. The Diderot effect is something you activate yourself.
It's all built in.
Yes, it's a cognitive bias that you activate yourself.
Okay, so where does that come from? Because I would wonder if a lot of our human behaviors I trace back to needing to live as a community in order for survival. So a lot of 100%. Our brain is geared to survival, right? So what is Diderot? How does Diderot relate to survival?
So it relates all the way back to when we first started. So at the very beginning, I mean, of course, we can't turn this into a history lesson, but, you know, it was all communal and everybody shared and it was all wonderful and stuff like that. And then, of course, you had the Industrial Revolution. Do you remember we talked about the Veblen effect and how the Veblen effect...
I forget. You have to remind me, Paul.
So the Veblen effect basically is conspicuous consumption. Do you remember we talked
about that? Oh, right. Yeah, yeah.
And so... Maybe we were talking about that off camera. I can't remember. But anyway, this idea of conspicuous consumption goes all the way back to this early 1800s industrial revolution kind of thing, where people had mm-hmm. a lot more money. And suddenly mm-hmm. we went from being communal, in where we were helping each other, because up until that time, everybody was poor. So if you had no food, your community came together and helped you, and so on and so mm-hmm. forth, right? And you weren't comparing yourself against everybody else, because everybody else was pretty much the same from
right.
that point in the late 1700s all the way back to medieval times. If you were right. not a member of nobility, or you were not a very rich merchant class, you were a peasant, and peasants didn't have anything. But then, mm-hmm. of course, the Industrial Revolution kicked in. Automation kicked in. Things started to become cheaper. We started to become a much more individualized society. We started to buy things to make ourselves feel good. Suddenly, we were now keeping up with the Joneses. In Victorian times, you had the merchant classes, who are now suddenly the middle class, which hadn't existed. Now the middle right. class wanted to differentiate themselves from the working class. So it was now, well, I can't possibly have a shabby room in my house, because that will show people that, you know, I'm not good enough. So suddenly that room is my entire identity until I fix it and I'll obsess about yeah. it. Even though nobody will ever see that room unless you invite mm-hmm. them in to show them. But mm-hmm. it's there in the back of your mind. And then it's essentially, it snowballs from there. And then we went into the 80s, where conspicuous consumption completely went out of control.
And it unbelievable.
Was, yes, and it was all about this hedonistic consumerism. And mm-hmm. it was very much more about how much more can you have? It was about indulgence and decadence and buying. And then into the 90s and the 2000s, it started to change a little bit. But now it was about the experience. Up until that point, it was showing off. So it wasn't really activating any of these chemicals in our brain, because we were doing it for show.
Right.
Whereas in the 90s, 2000s, 2010, we suddenly started talking about the experience that we're getting. How are we experiencing this? And suddenly, we now want to feel more. We now want to feel the rush of sitting in a 7 Series BMW, even though I own a 5 Series one.
Yes.
So I'm no longer buying this 7 Series to show off to my neighbor. It's only part of it. But I want the rush of having already had a 5 Series. I'm now bored with it. It was great when I got it, but the Diderot effect has kicked in. Luxury changes. It's no longer luxury to me. I now need a 7 Series. The 7 Series you get, everybody goes, oh my God, wow, you feel amazing. You have a personalized mm-hmm. experience. All the chemicals are firing. And now suddenly you're bored with the 7 Series. And now you need a Bentley.
Yeah.
So our behavior and our adaptation to this phenomenon of why we buy and how we buy changed dramatically during the 70s and 80s.
But so going back to my original question then about how it relates to our survival, I suppose what then I'm hearing is that it seems to be about social survival now.
It is social because, survival. I mean, we don't actually need it to survive. It started with the whole idea of everybody helps everybody out. Because remember, mm-hmm. if you were alone back then, you died.
You died. And also,
survival of the fittest or the survival of the community.
Well, yeah. And then I suppose if you had a better knife or a better axe or a better spear, you were more likely to get your supper. So then your survival is then so.
But
yes,
you would
it's
share
like,
that because you were part of the community.
So we're upgrading. But also, I do wonder, and obviously we don't know, but I do. I mean, they always had hierarchies, didn't they, in these things? Like there was a chief of the village, and there was a. So I, you know, there was. I wonder if the person who had the best knife would be the, like, leader, and therefore their survival was more guaranteed because they were the leader of the tribe or the village or whatever, the community. Do you see what I mean?
You're going into prestige positions there.
Yeah.
The,
because, but...
Go on.
Go on.
No, absolutely. The Incas were very good at this.
Oh, are they?
Yeah.
Go on, tell me, because I do like knowing about this stuff.
They they obviously sacrificed hundreds, thousands of people every year to their gods for their survival. You know, they were nuts when it came to sacrificing.
So like, oh, look, another one.
Yeah, exactly. It's like,
that looks like rain. Better sacrifice someone.
Let's plunder this village. Gather up all of the people, then we can use those for the sacrifices.
Isn't that how they learnt to make soap? Sorry to interrupt you. But isn't that how they learnt to make soap?
Is it?
So I'm sure I read somewhere. Now, I'm terrible for this, but I think I've read something somewhere.
Soap is, or was, made out fat. Of fat, yeah.
Yes. So what was happening was that they were sacrificing these people, and then when they were burning them, the things were going into the river, and they were finding that where they were cleaning clothes and things in the river where all these things were draining to, they were getting cleaner. And so that's how soap was discovered. I'm sure, look, I could be talking utter rot, so don't quote me on it. I'm going to Google this later and have to look it up because I read somewhere that it was something about things draining into the river, and that was how they knew that it would help things get cleaner.
How curious. Mm. No, I have no idea.
This is the ADHD pit brain right at work. No, this one little piece of information. Whether that happened.
But I mean, they were very much a hierarchical society in terms of, you know, if you had better weapons and you were a better fighter and stuff like that, then you were more revered. The Spartans were exactly the same. But that's survival of the fittest. That's not quite what consumerism is, because you're not really surviving of the fittest. It's now the survival of the show-off, isn't it?
But it's social survival rather than physical survival.
It is social survival, but that social survival is a perception in your own head, because it's not real social survival unless you're in a very particular social bubble. So if you lived in suburbia in outside London, I suppose, Chiswick maybe, if you I suppose you have to have a particular car, a particular house if you want
that definitely happens around where I am,
if you want to live in the W4 postcode, and then I suppose yes, your garden, what you have in your garden, your garden furniture, your barbecuing, the front of your house, the furniture inside your house. So yes, then the Diderot effect would kick in there for sure. Because suddenly,
I do look at my kitchen table and think it needs replacing because it's an IKEA table and everything else is not.
And there you go. You see, you've got... And yet the table is perfectly functional. There's nothing wrong with it.
And it is perfectly functional and it will stay because there is my rational brain going, I'm not wasting money on a kitchen table to spend more money on a table that's going to be abused by two children who have no heed for whether or not it costs 200 quid or 2,000 pounds, which, you know, also there is something moral that will stop me spending that at this point. I just want to let you know, I did look up the origin of soap and I'd like to read to you if you were talking.
Yeah. How sneaky you are. Well, go on, tell us the origin of soap.
So apparently there's a couple of different versions, but the story I was quoting and misquoted somewhat was that the Romans discovered rope. Ancient Roman legend gives soap its name from Mount Sapo, where animals were sacrificed. Rain washed a mixture of melted animal fats and wood ashes down into the Tiber River below. Thereby, the soap mixture was discovered to be useful for washing clothing and skin. So it was sacrificed, but not humans. So I was close, but not, you know.
Wow, that's so interesting.
Isn't it? I love it.
I did not know that at all.
Yeah. There is another, what's it called? Ancient, I want to say ancient species, but that's the wrong word. Civilization that are also credited for discovering it. But
who?
No, that was, you're going to make me pronounce it and I can't. Ancient Mesopotamians.
Mesopotamians.
Oh, there you go. Mesopotamians. But they produced soap by cooking fatty acids, but it doesn't say how they discovered it.
So, not through sacrifice. I don't think the Mesopotamians sacrificed people. But so that's quite interesting. But anyway, the Diderot effect, the next time you buy something and you feel the urge to buy something else because you've bought something, a luxury good, know that you are being influenced not by people like me, but by yourself.
By your own self.
Yes. So look out for the Diderot effect. So, and it even happens when you go shopping in the supermarket.
Really?
Because, yes, of course. Because if you buy an expensive bottle of champagne, then you're going to need nice glasses to drink it out of.
If you buy a steak, you need to have a nice bottle of red to go with it.
To go with it. This is the Diderot effect.
Goodness me.
Absolutely.
It's everywhere, isn't it?
It is everywhere, absolutely.
No escaping the Diderot effect.
We are opening your eyes to these psychological influences.
That you can do absolutely nothing about.
Yeah, I'm probably going to put myself out of a job. That's the problem.
No.
If I give you all the secrets.
Well, maybe we'll just keep them all a little bit. Keep a few of them to ourselves. Just a few.
I'm keeping the dark magic ones to myself.
The Machiavellian ones.
Oh, and you're straight to the dark triad again. Absolutely,
Helen. Of course
Helen.
There I we go. Am. Of course I am. You're all always right. To the consumerism, Paul.
Absolutely. So but I mean, you know.
We like our places in the world.
Anyway. That's it for this week, I think. I think we'll leave it there. The Diderot effect, very interesting. You buy something.
Very interesting.
You want something more, and you keep buying, and basically you trick yourself, influence yourself into upgrading. You know? It's essentially give an inch, take a mile on crack.
Absolutely. So just remember, you do not need the matching shoes. Or maybe you do. Who knows?
You're already, the cognitive dissonance has kicked in. Yeah, but you can't have the new dress without the shoes. And I only have 450 pairs, so I have nothing to wear.
It's the truth though, Paul.
Don't forget to like, subscribe, comment, tell us if the Diderot effect have you succumbed to the Diderot effect? Especially if you're a luxury consumer. And let us know if there's anything you would like to discuss on the podcast. And we will see you next week.
Fabulous. See you next week, everyone. Take care.
Bye.